So I thought I would try to organize my lecture sort of along the following lines that I know many of you are not specialists in LTP or in biochemistry, but I know you all are interested in the fundamental question of how synaptic weights are controlled, what is the molecular basis for the stability of long-term information storage. And so I thought what I'd do sort of in the first 45 minutes is give a kind of background talk in which I talked about the phenomenon of LTP a little bit, what we know about it, what constraints it places on the process of synaptic weight storage, why I originally came up with this idea of positive feedback autocatalytic reactions, and what subsequently has been learned about a particular molecule, CAM kinase 2, that seems to have some of these properties, some of the tests that were done to examine whether CAM kinase does indeed play a critical role in LTP. And with that as background, we can take a little pause and you can ask me some questions at that point about the background. Then I'd like to start sort of the more detailed examination of what actually is the third generation model. As Sebastian said, this was work that started in 1985, and that was the first model. Then we came out about 5 years later with a much more specific model. And then as time evolved and people did certain kinds of tests, it really became necessary to go into a third generation model, and that just recently has come out. And I want to spend the second half of my talk going in detail through that third generation model. So what you see before you is a pyramidal cell from the CA1 region of the hippocampus. And the hippocampus, as you know, is a place where we believe that information of storage occurs. And the CA1 region in particular is where almost all the studies of LTP have been done. And what I'm going to really talk about is the what's known about CA1 LTP, but you should know that, yeah, there are many other parts of the brain which share this kind of LTP, but on the other hand, we now know that there are other forms of LTP which may be exhibited in other parts of the brain. If you zoom in on the dendrites, you immediately see something very interesting, which is that the dendrites are studded with tiny little appendages called dendritic spines. These are about 1 micron in length, and many, many of the synapses onto the pyramidal cell are actually located on these dendritic spines. I think this is an informative picture because it gives you an idea just of how many spines there are. There probably often are 10,000 spines on a pyramidal cell. And in the next slide, and these are beautiful pictures by Kristen Harris. This is actually a reconstruction from EM. And you can see now how varied in structure and size spines are. And they're roughly about 3 spines per micron of dendrite. And this is a freeze fracture picture of an individual spine. And now you should be able to see the synapse itself. So here is the spine. This actually is the region of the synapse itself. And you can tell that because the presynaptic terminal is very recognizable by the large number of synaptic vesicles you see there. So when the action potential arrives, these vesicles fuse, release calcium into the cleft, and affect the receptors, which you can just sort of see in the freeze fracture. These are probably receptors right here on the postsynaptic side. And Now we can...
The refractor is supposed to cut along membrane.
It does. It's and these are particles in the membrane. And so here you see the synapse, very high density of particles, and these particles are almost certainly the glutamate sensitive channels. So these are glutamatergic synapses, and you all know that the glutamate sensitive channels are divided into two basic types of conducting channels. One type is called the AMPA channels, and they're thought to be the dominant form and responsible for generating the postsynaptic electrical response. But
get the geometry straight, but the presynaptic side was originally covering this, and it got fractured off like that.
Well, actually, Fries fracture splits down the middle of the membrane. So, but you are looking down on the synapse, you're right in that sense. So right here might be where the vesicles are, and now we've split through the plane. And so the other type of channels that are localized here are fewer in number, and these are called the NMDA channels. And their job seems to be less to influence the electrical event, but rather to act as some sort of triggering mechanism for synaptic plasticity. So they respond to the glutamate, as you see, they also, you'll see in a minute, they also respond to postsynaptic depolarization. And these two factors cause the NMDA channels to open and to allow calcium entry into the spine. Now, let's just look at what an LTP experiment typically looks like. And there are lots of time scales illustrated on this figure, so you kind of have to keep the time scale straight. So here on a very fast time scale, you can see the individual postsynaptic response to a single shock given to the presynaptic axon. So this would be just the baseline measure of transmission strength of the synapse. And the way you induce LTP is to then give a whole series of shocks to the presynaptic axon at about 100 per second. And this will cause lots of postsynaptic firing. And the interesting thing is that if you then go back and give these single shocks, these test shocks, that now the single shock gives you a bigger amplitude response. So LTP, the increase in synaptic strength, is going from an EPSP, an excitatory postsynaptic response, that looks like this before LTP, to something like this after LTP.
And
no, this is the postsynaptic cell. So this is what you would see if you were recording during the tetanus from the postsynaptic. No. This is actually a group of axons. This is not a single axon being stimulated. And so in a lot of the plots you'll see of LTP, what people do is just they give these kinds of shocks over and over again, just measure a single parameter of the amplitude, and then plot it like this over the time scale of hours, just giving these test stimuli over and over and over. And here you can see that the tetanus was given, now the EPSP is bigger, and it decays a little bit, but it stays stably bigger for hours. And I now have heard a group that has monitored this in vivo, and that it stays larger for at least a year. The interesting thing is that you can take two stimulating electrodes and monitor separately the response, in a sense, to two sets of inputs to the same target cell. And when you do that, you can see that inducing LTP in one pathway, the pathway that you stimulated, does nothing to the second pathway. But later on, you can stimulate the second pathway. And one of the classic results about LTP induction is that there is a way to easily block it. So if you apply a blocker to the NMDA channel and give the same tetanus, you get no LTP. If you take away that blocker, APV, and now try to induce LTP, you get LTP. So the NMDA channel must be important.
That's true in some, but not all areas, right?
Yes. Now, one of the hallmarks of the CA1 LTP is its Hebbian character. And this is just a nice experiment that showed the importance of postsynaptic depolarization in order to get LTP. So here, in one set of experiments, just normal LTP, but in a second set of experiments, the only difference was that while the tetanus was given, negative current was injected into the postsynaptic cell. And that brief tetanus combined with that brief negative current resulted in the block of LTP. So we now know that you do need substantial postsynaptic depolarization as one of the requirements to get LTP. And that's what we mean by the Hebbian character of LTP.
We had a speech from Ku talking here about 2 weeks ago, so I want to connect your two talks. And he was talking seriously about the difference in time between the first, the presynaptic and postsynaptic spiking. Now, in your experience, in this experiment you talk, you're described without the polarization. The presynaptic neuron fires, and the postsynaptic neuron, does it fire or just it depolarize? What happens to the postsynaptic neuron when you recover?
Well, the postsynaptic neuron would ordinarily fire during a tetanus, as I showed you.
It's between the fire spike of the presynaptic and the postsynaptic neuron.
So these, I mean, in LTP, as generally speaking, people haven't been concerned about spike timing issues. That's been a later generation of experiments. So in these experiments, as I showed you, that 1 second tetanus, you know, gave a huge depolarization. That was that middle panel over here. And it gave you lots of spikes. And meanwhile, there were lots of presynaptic spikes, so everything is kind of averaged out. Now, I don't think we should discuss spike timing LTP right now. We can do it over coffee later. So one of the hallmarks of LTP is its synapse specificity. So by the Hebb rule, a synapse which was not active would not get potentiated. Oh, yeah, please. No, down below. Whereas, you know, a synapse just a few microns away, which was active, would get potentiated. And so we have to be looking for signals which are highly localized. And over the years now, there's been a lot of biophysical work looking at the calcium entry through the NMDA channel. It turns out the NMDA channel is highly permeable. Using fluorescent indicators, you can look to see whether calcium elevation occurs, and you can look to see whether the calcium elevation is due to the NMDA channel, and you can look to see what its spatial spread is. And this shows you an experiment that was done in Arthur Connor's lab. I was involved in these experiments, and it's now possible to actually find an active synapse and to know with certainty that it is active because every time you stimulate it, or not every time you stimulate, some fraction of the time you stimulate the presynaptic axon, you will get release. And when you get release, inevitably some small amount of calcium will flow through the NMDA channels, and so you can detect transmission at an individual synapse and see its probabilistic character. Now you absolutely know that this synapse is an active one, and you can study in detail the calcium entry as a function of voltage and or pharmacological perturbations. And so here you see the calcium signal in response to a burst in order to make the signal reliable. You put on APV to block the NMDA channels, the signal goes away, you take away the APV, and the signal returns. And you can see how exquisitely localized that calcium entry is, and so could serve as a basis for triggering the synapse-specific modification. And people have done other types of experiments using calcium buffers to mop up that calcium elevation, and that is sufficient to block LTP. So it is generally accepted that the trigger for LTP is calcium entry through the NMDA channel. And the beautiful thing about calcium entry through the NMDA channel is that it executes the NMDA channel is smart enough to execute the Hebb rule, because it's a glutamate activated channel, but glutamate is not sufficient. You also need postsynaptic depolarization to increase the calcium entry, and don't get confused by the negative sign here. The more you depolarize up to a point, the more calcium entry you get through the NMDA channel. So this alone is sufficient, we believe, to account for the Hebbian character of LTP at these synapses. Now, I want to sort of remind you of the cell and the 10,000 synapses, because this sort of picture was really influential in my entry into this field of synaptic strength modification and the molecular basis of long-term memory, because it just seemed to me obvious that if you were going to have 10,000 synapses scattered around this huge cell, each one of which had to be independently modifiable, and if you wanted to understand the memory processes that would remember how strong each synapse should be, that the basis, the mechanisms of storage would have to be local. And if the storage mechanism is local, then the involvement of the nucleus and the DNA-dependent processes of translation, it seemed to me, had to be unimportant in any profound sense. And that if you thought of it as a process of localization, of how you would build something at a synapse that could store information, you pretty much were driven to the conclusion that it had to be something involving proteins. Now, subsequently, there are some other interesting ideas that have come up, that maybe you could have local RNA in dendrites, and that you could have some sort of positive feedback loop involving RNA. And I think that is still a very interesting possibility that needs to be pursued. But the direction that I took this problem was to ask the question, could you come up with some sort of scheme by which proteins could do information storage on a very long time scale? And if you're going to say that, you really have to come up with some answer to the question of protein turnover. You need to have stable information storage by proteins despite protein turnover. So,
yeah.
So the
experiment you show is a stimulation and then a single ESP.
Right.
Now, if LTP depends on back rotation of the spark, which then might have been activate Hebbian channel.
Mm-hmm.
So which one, gives you more calcium influx? And your channel
or
the voltage activated calcium channel?
So
by back rotation spark.
This is, first of all, we have to discuss now, again, spike time-independent plasticity as opposed to, to something like a tetanus. So, I think I'd like to just defer that question. It's a very complicated question. And actually, I think we aren't anywhere near the end of useful biophysics to study that question. There really has been a paucity of work, even though, a lot of work could, interesting work could be done. Right, so you're saying, I mean, what you're saying is that that there are voltage-dependent calcium channels, and in fact they are in spines, we know that. But no matter how you look at it, if you have just voltage-dependent calcium channels open, you're going to get X, but if you have voltage-dependent calcium channels and NMDA channels, you're going to get X plus Y.
And what are the ratio between X and Y?
It's not known.
Carlson, so Beloda has been measuring that.
People are getting it. So anyway, now we're getting to really, you know, the substance of what I want to get to, which is the question of how you would build a switch that would be made out of proteins. And I want to give you just get you to sort of where I was in 1985. I was sort of learning about protein kinases and what generally was known about them. And so what I did was sort of learn a little bit, because actually I was working on protein kinases in a totally different context of phototransduction. And so I started learning about these funny things, and I thought, well, maybe you could put this together to make a switch. So what did I learn about? Well, first of all, everybody, you know, had seen throughout biochemical control mechanisms the power of protein phosphorylation to change target protein function. So what the enzyme that does phosphorylation is called a kinase. It takes a small molecule called ATP, which has lots of energy stored in it, and it has three phosphates attached to the ATP molecule. What the kinase does is take the terminal phosphate and stick it covalently onto a target protein. So it modifies covalently the target. And in thousands and thousands of cases, it has been found that this phosphorylation is regulatory of the target. And it can do anything you can imagine. Sometimes the target protein, you know, gets more active, sometimes it gets less active. It seems to depend upon the particular case. But it is one of the main regulatory mechanisms used to control biochemical reactions. And the second thing that really intrigued me was that it turned out that there were examples of protein kinases that could phosphorylate themselves. And we'll come back to whether we mean phosphorylate themselves or molecules like itself. And that was called autophosphorylation. And all this model really did, this was a sort of a generic model of a switch, was to say, hey, let's put these two ideas together and you could make a switch. So here's the kinase unphosphorylated and inactive, so there's no star. And then I thought, well, some stimulus comes along, maybe calcium, and it causes this thing to get phosphorylated. And I wasn't even clear who was responsible for the phosphorylation. But once it got phosphorylated, it became active, and among the things that it could phosphorylate was itself. So you had a little autocatalytic positive feedback loop. And then all you had to do is say that this positive feedback loop was stronger than the phosphatase. So a phosphatase is another kind of protein which goes over to a phosphorylated protein and removes the phosphate. So even if you had a phosphatase trying to remove the phosphate at some low rate, kinetically, if this rate of rephosphorylation was larger than the rate of the phosphatase, you'd get stable phosphorylation. And if you imagine that this was a group of molecules, then it wouldn't be really a molecular switch, but a kind of a system, a chemical system that acted like a switch. And as a result of it being a system that acted like a switch, it had the nice property that you could take individual molecules out And because of the cooperative nature of this process, you could reinsert an unphosphorylated molecule, and if all the rest were phosphorylated, they would rephosphorylate the new, you know, that one. So you could begin to see how the chemical system would be able to store information, even though none of the molecules hung around for very long. And that was really an important design requirement from the beginning. So this was the first generation model, and really the principles, the underlying principles haven't changed. What's changed over the years is, you know, which molecule is this? How exactly does it work? You know, what are the biochemists discovering each new week? And trying to build a model which really incorporates all these very detailed findings. Right.
Solutions. It seems to me that the solution where all of the hydrides in the state is not stable, because the moment a little bit becomes phosphorylated, it will continue to the higher.
Okay, so you know, you probably are running the simulation so fast in your mind that you've gotten the right answer. There are a few other complications. So when we really wanted to see this thing work, what we wound up doing was letting this phosphatase get saturated when this gets high, when this gets very high. So, in a sense, there's a nonlinearity that comes into play. And so the strength of this reaction, in a sense, effectively goes down when this becomes high. And that allows a situation to make this state stable. And you'll see this very graphically. I'm going to show you. Yes. If you absolutely, not indefinitely, but for a long time.
How can you switch it back?
Okay, we'll come to that. Okay, so now the next sort of major thing that happened had to do with a very, very exciting candidate molecule. So even at the time that I proposed this model in 1985, I already had a kind of idea about what kinase might be the best candidate. And here's the reason. So here we see an electron micrograph of a synapse. And this is now a transmission electron micrograph. And what you see here is the synapse, the presynaptic, the postsynaptic side, and an absolutely classical indicator of an excitatory synapse in the brain is something called the postsynaptic density. So do you see how all this dark fuzz on the postsynaptic side? That is the postsynaptic density. And it's not present at inhibitory synapses. And it turned out that biochemists could isolate that postsynaptic density, characterize the molecules in it, and what they found was that it was full of a particular protein kinase called CAM kinase 2. So there are many, many different kinases, different molecular weights, different properties. So here they found a kinase that could be activated by calcium, the very second messenger which we thought to be the trigger for LTP. So that was cute. The fact that it was immobilized in this structure was highly suggestive, because we're trying to do synapse-specific modification, and so we want to have something that is stuck at the synapse.
Does it know why inhibitory synapses don't have this?
Well, most inhibitory synapses are probably not plastic.
So you're saying that all that fuzz is CAM kinase?
No.
Or it's
no.
Like scaffolding for...
There's lots and lots of other stuff. So CAM kinase is maybe 5 or 10% of that fuzz.
So inhibitory synapses should also have some complicated machinery.
Well, we'll come back to that.
And that maybe this is the typical synapse on the pyramidal cell or on the neuron?
I think it doesn't.
Okay.
So the next spectacular... No, I think I think there can be CAM kinase excitatory synapses onto interneurons.
But there is none at on inhibitory synapses.
Right. And in fact, this is demonstrated here. So this is from Ted Jones. And so this is immunohistochemistry, where you actually take an antibody to a molecule. And so here you see a spine, and here you see a presynaptic terminal. And this is the postsynaptic density. And these arrows point to the label that is conferred upon this structure by the binding of CAM kinase antibody. So this is CAM kinase here. And here you see an inhibitory synapse. How do you know that? Because these little dots label GABA, the main inhibitory neurotransmitter. You can see that the synapse here, you can see that it is not asymmetric, and you can see that there's no dense labeling on the postsynaptic side for CAM kinase. Now, the really exciting finding.
So you said it's an E2E connection effect or it's a sectoral connection. There are kinases. The I2E, there are no.
Right.
It's about the E2I, there are, and the I2R, there are not.
I think it's the postsynaptic density is taken to be a sign of excitatory synapses. So I think that it's fair to say that most excitatory synapses, whether they're onto pyramidal cells or onto interneurons, have this postsynaptic density. So this is work from Mary Kennedy's lab, and it sort of is probably the single strongest experiment indicating that CAM kinase biochemically is designed to be some sort of switch. So, first of all, it was already known that the molecule was one of these kinases which could phosphorylate itself. It had autophosphorylation. And what she's doing is measuring this autophosphorylation as a function of time. And if you don't add any calcium, there's no autophosphorylation. So this is an off enzyme. If you add calcium, you can get it to autophosphorylate itself up to a certain saturating level. So it puts phosphate onto itself until all the sites are phosphorylated. So the key point of this experiment occurs at this arrow. And in one set of experiments, I can't remember whether it's the dark or the light circles, partway through the autophosphorylation reaction, she took away all the calcium. Now, what you might have thought is, well, you take away the calcium, you're taking away the stimulus, this thing is going to stop autophosphorylating itself. But to the contrary, it continued on as if you had left the calcium there. So that's the evidence that autophosphorylation not only occurs, but that it switches this molecule into a new kind of catalytic state where it no longer requires calcium to be active. So those, in a sense, were the two key parts of the model I showed you, that autophosphorylation occurs and that the autophosphorylated state is active and no longer needs the stimulus.
So this experiment, I didn't understand, is it a pure system? Is it just
CAM? Yeah, kinase? So absolutely. This was done on absolutely pure CAM kinase.
CAM kinase and phosphate and calcium. And
right, not phosphate, but ATP.
ATP. And the vertical axis is?
This is watching it incorporate phosphates into itself over time.
But exactly what is the vertical axis?
Moles of phosphate incorporated.
There's no phosphatase.
There's no phosphatase here.
There's more than one phosphate per subject?
Yes, in fact.
Okay. And it's done by what, radio labeling or?
Yeah.
Can you see the dollar? Because you just hear the flat trajectory in the bank.
Oh, I'm sorry. Absolutely. Yeah.
Isn't it surprising that the time course remains the same?
I mean, this has to do with, you know, gory details of protein folding. I wouldn't have made any statement about it one way or the other, to tell you the truth.
What's the third line?
This line is if you don't add calcium at all. So nothing basically happens if you don't add calcium. If you take calcium and leave it there, you get this. If you take calcium and take it away part way, you get this. Okay. This is actually very confusing. She actually did those experiments, and well, so it turns out that this is an enormous molecule containing 12 subunits, each of which has many phosphorylation sites. But we think that the critical site that does this switching, is a particular site called threonine 286 on the alpha subunit. And to make things still more confusing, there's a slightly different kind of subunit called a beta subunit. But the bottom line is, and this you'll see this is very important later, this is a hyperphosphorylated molecule. In other words, this one molecule might eventually get as many as 100 phosphorylations on it and as a function when it's fully phosphorylated. And this is going to be very important in terms of a critical idea, even of that first generation model, which was that when the thing gets very phosphorylated, the phosphatase can get overwhelmed, can get saturated. So you'll see how important that is in a minute.
Are there other calcium-activated autocatalytic molecules that have been found?
No. And even close relatives of this, like CAM kinase 4, CAM kinase 1, don't have these exact properties.
And you said this before, but so is this just CAM kinase 2 in solution?
This is purified CAM kinase in solution.
Including all the 12 subunits?
Yeah, this is a whole, what we call a holoenzyme. It's the big structure. A real enzyme. You can take it apart if you want to, but they didn't do that here. You can separately measure when you're done what happened to alpha and beta.
But that's you regard that as demonstration of bisubstability?
No, not at all.
Not at all?
No. Well, I demonstrate that is just showing that when the molecule gets phosphorylated, it no longer needs calcium, it gets switched into a state where it can now phosphorylate itself without calcium. There's no phosphatase here, so this is not a real biological system. So bistability, you have to recreate the living situation, and you want to show that in a dynamic system, you can have two stable states. So she doesn't have a dynamic system going on in the test tube. We're thinking actually now of doing experiments where we actually, in a test tube, create the switch, which would be dynamic in character.
I would like to know whether this saturation is really saturation or whether the level changes. For example, when you apply twice the time, calcium.
Now that's remember that there's going to be a finite number of target sites. So, yeah, you can phosphorylate all the target sites, and then there are no more left to phosphorylate.
That's the state reached there?
That's in a test tube, yes, that's the state reached.
Did she demonstrate saturation by doubling the time of calcium?
Well, you can see it reached a steady state.
Okay. That's what was there all the time.
Right, in the one case. So, one thing you could ask, I'm just going to go on because otherwise we'll... the best estimates are on the order of a micromolar, which, by the way, is much lower than the levels that occur during LTP in a spine. So the one question you could ask is, when you induce LTP, do you in fact get a change in the kinase? So biochemists would take a hippocampal slice, either not induce LTP or induce LTP, or they can induce LTP, or they can wait various times after, up to an hour. Then they take the slice, they grind it up, they do a biochemical assay, and they ask, have you switched the kinase? How do you know whether you've switched the kinase? You ask whether it's active without calcium, because only if it's been autophosphorylated will it be active without calcium. And so concentrate here. Before LTP, you've got this much calcium-independent activity. After LTP, you have more calcium-independent activity, and it stays elevated even if you let the slice sit there for an hour before grinding it up. And if you stimulate with the same number of action potentials but don't induce LTP because you use low-frequency stimulation, you get no LTP, and you get no switching of the kinase. So this has now been repeated over and over and over again. We know a whole lot about this. We know where the CAM kinase is phosphorylated. It's phosphorylated at the 286 site. We know that this is CAM kinase that is at synapses. So this is a very robust finding, and I'll show you some other interesting properties of this later on. So CAM kinase gets switched and is persistent after LTP. Is that necessary? So now there have been 50 experiments that have asked in different ways, is CAM kinase necessary for LTP? And there were a whole set of pharmacological papers. So with various different kinds of inhibitors, you put them into the cell, you give a tetanus, do you get LTP? No, you don't get LTP. And this has been done with three or four different kinds of pharmacological inhibitors. Then there was the CAM kinase knockout experiment done by Tonegawa and Silva. So now you just knock out alpha CAM kinase. Do you get LTP? No. And recently, Silva did a spectacular experiment where he said, I'm not going to do a gross perturbation. I'm going to leave the CAM kinase in there, but I'm just going to mutate the 286 site so that it can't autophosphorylate itself. So it can be active transiently, but it can't go into the self-sustaining mode because it can't autophosphorylate itself on this critical site. And with that single point mutation, you block LTP. So I think we know definitely that CAM kinase is necessary. I'm just going to go to the end, and then you can ask me some more questions. So the next question you could ask is, can you mimic LTP by just putting active CAM kinase into the cell? Okay, so this was a set of experiments done by Tom Soderling, and the physiology was done by Roger Nichols. So they made a form of CAM kinase which was constitutively active. So nothing the cell could do would be able to turn this thing off. Right. So they perfused it into the postsynaptic cell, and what you find is that the synaptic response gets bigger and bigger and bigger as the kinase goes in. Then they did a spectacular experiment, I think. They said, supposing we first induce LTP in one pathway. So now we've pre-potentiated. Now let's perfuse in the kinase. So actually, this is the same experiment. On the pathway that had already been potentiated, putting in the kinase didn't have much effect. So this is occlusion. It says that not only can you potentiate, but you can only potentiate the synapses with exogenous kinase if they haven't already been potentiated by the LTP process. And Yeah, you're absolutely right, but they just normalized the responses here. So just to finish up, this sort of by way of introduction and to get back to one of the questions, you all know that LTP has the property of reversibility. So there are protocols that you can give which will give LTP, and then if you change the stimulation frequency to a different kind of protocol or the spike timing to a different kind of protocol, you can get the reversal of LTP. So what we're looking for here is a system by which you can reversibly strengthen synapse. So you have to have some sort of molecular mechanism that goes up but also can come down. And this is a whole gigantic seminar in and of itself, and I'm not going to get into it today at all. But again, going back to some ideas that I developed about how this might occur, which, as it turns out, have been borne out pretty well. The general idea is this, that at synapses, different protocols lead to different levels of calcium. And an LTP protocol leads to a very high level of calcium, but a weakening protocol leads to a lower level of calcium. The lower level of calcium, which in many cases also is due to a more weakly activated NMDA channel, leads to this blue level of calcium and comes over and activates a phosphatase cascade, which winds up dephosphorylating CAM kinase. So the interesting point is that if you have a switch which is using phosphorylation to maintain itself, it can serve as a target for a whole other cascade which will rip that phosphate off and reset the switch. So this is a class of models where you can see pretty simply how reversibility would occur. And as I said, I don't want to go into the details of it, but the basic point that phosphatases, the activation of phosphatases, are responsible for weakening processes has been demonstrated over and over and over again, as has the idea that it's sort of modest elevations of calcium which are the trigger for the weakening processes. So both weakening and strengthening are calcium dependent. The difference seems to be the level, and now it gets very fuzzy. If you really try to nail me on what levels, I think that still a lot of work needs to be done on this, but the basic idea seems to be holding up. So I just wanted to mention that we have, at least a good working hypothesis about how you make this into a reversible system.
So you think the phosphatase cascade can only act on the ionic switch being on, because it would not explain then LTP on synapses that are.
Well, not quite, but so the working model now in the field is that LTD, which is, as you say, working on a synapse which hasn't previously been potentiated, is actually biochemically different and then weakening which reverses potentiation. The weakening that reverses potentiation, I'll show you a slide later, appears to be the reversal of the CAM kinase process. The weakening that occurs during LTD is the removal of a phosphate put on by constitutive cyclic A kinase.
Phosphate put on CAM
kinase? No, put on the AMPA channel. Right. So this slide also emphasizes something which it'll be important to keep in mind, that, well, how does CAM kinase strengthen the synapse? So how does the switch do anything? Well, there's a lot of evidence that one way it can strengthen the synapse, but not the only way. One way it can strengthen the synapse is by phosphorylating the AMPA channel. So CAM kinase phosphorylates the AMPA channel, and when the AMPA channel is phosphorylated, it becomes more conducting.
The mechanism for it to occur in the postsynaptic cell. Now, we all know that there is a long debate about LTP, whether it's presynaptic and postsynaptic, and nobody knows what's going on. And some people think it's, so there is no strong conclusion whether it's presynaptic or postsynaptic. So how does your model go together with the idea if LTP were presynaptic?
So I consider what you said wrong. I think there's definitive evidence for the postsynaptic. There's just more evidence than you could ever hope to get. Whether there's also presynaptic is another question. But the idea of pure presynaptic change is just implausible at this time.
So you want to tell us how we retrograde the
signal? No, I'm not. I'm going to concentrate totally on the postsynaptic. And when it's worked out definitively that there is a presynaptic component, and I consider it not definitive that there even is, much less what the mechanism is, then we can get to it. But I certainly don't exclude the possibility of a presynaptic form of LTP. I'm just not convinced yet. And part of the problem is that there's no mechanism. What has made it absolutely convincing about the postsynaptic side is that the mechanism is now known. So you can't argue about it anymore. I mean, we know the mechanism of it. And there's so many elements of the postsynaptic, and you'll see this developing in the course of my talk.
No.
As it has to stay phosphorylated to be changed. So, to the extent that it's long term, it's only because the kinase is long term activated.
Let's get back a couple slides. The kinase not yet learned.
Okay. So. Yes, that was an obvious question. That's why they wanted to make the knockout. You get into this gray zone. So in my view, you know, it's a very, very difficult set of issues because, of course, they have learning defects. Well, not of course. I mean, so the finding was they had learning defects. But they're not huge. And now we're going to get into a very gray area. What about beta CAM kinase? They only knocked out alpha. What about the beta? It's a very messy issue. So I would say that my evaluation of the learning experiments, well, they showed a phenotype, but the crucial experiments, you know, to really get an incredibly dramatic effect may still have to be done. Okay, so now we get into another thing is, did they really, really eliminate all of LTP, or was there residue? So there's been a controversy about that, and yes, you can find some residual LTP in the CAM kinase alpha knockout. Could that be due to beta? Yeah. Could it be due to some other mechanism? Yeah.
Would this whole idea predict that the sound
is going to be too stable? Yes, and so I'm going to have a whole part of my talk, because I think as a physicist, this is a very interesting question, and I think the answer is not known, but I want to really discuss that at length later.
What else?
The answer is really not known, but to the extent that there is evidence, it looks like a two.
The
model is not two-state either necessarily, because there's some subtleties that you'll see later.
So my understanding is early and late phase LTP, are they both CAM kinase dependent?
Yes.
How fast is induction of LTP?
Well, I mean, a one-second tetanus is on the long side. I have a protocol where I can induce LTP in 30 milliseconds.
Yeah, but you can detect when you...
Oh, you mean how long does it take to appear?
Yeah.
They've only been a few... It's a very difficult experiment because there's some presynaptic changes that occur, and you have to answer the question, you have to make sure you don't get fooled by some of these presynaptic changes, but the work that was done by Gustafson, which really controlled for this, suggested that it can appear within 10 seconds.
But the time scale for the autophosphorylation of CAM kinase was minutes.
That was done at 1 degree. So when you take into consideration the kinetics at room temperature, you can switch the molecule in a second. So, I just want to finish this introduction by sort of giving you a little advance idea of what may be going on, and I think it'll inform, you know, the way you're thinking about it already, and some of these issues about binary control and the whole thing. So, in this paper that we recently published, we put together a lot of evidence to propose that although one mechanism of the readout of the switch is biphosphorylation of the AMPA channel, there's a whole other mechanism for readout which is constructive in nature. That is to say, you build a different kind of synapse. And the seed for the construction process is the switch. So it's a structural process that is seeded by the on state of the switch. So here you have what we consider the core component of a silent synapse. And silent synapses have been discovered and characterized. These are synapses which lack AMPA channels, but have NMDA channels. And after LTP, it's now completely clear by any number of direct and indirect assays that you add postsynaptic AMPA channels to these silent synapses. And that's what I meant by unequivocal evidence for a postsynaptic process. That you add AMPA channels to this structure. And here is sort of our version of how we think this happens under the control of CAM kinase. And there's evidence that CAM kinase can drive this conversion from a silent synapse to what is called an amplified synapse. A synapse that contains AMPA channels. So this shows you CAM kinase getting activated and phosphorylated. When it gets phosphorylated, it binds to the NMDA channel. So this is a revolutionary idea. The two biggest players in this thing, CAM kinase and the NMDA channel, wind up making an activity-dependent complex. How does this complex then amplify the synapse? We believe that there's some sort of linker, and I'll show you what we think this linker does. So a structural linker, which makes a site for capturing new AMPA channels and holding them at the synapse. So it's an anchoring thing. It's a structural anchoring thing. So the switch makes a structural anchor that holds AMPA channels at the synapse. So this is a whole completely different way of looking at the strengthening process that's very different from this phosphorylation of AMPA channels, of existing AMPA channels, and we'll discuss this in great detail. It has a lot of implications about how you think about the synapse if there's this structural component involved.
So if you say there are no AMPA channels, you really kind of very strong.
Well,
there is one spike in the postsynaptic terminal, then there will be a greater response in the postsynaptic.
Right.
And there are, if there are two spikes coming, there will be also a stronger response. Now, Henry Markham.
Not necessarily, because you have to discuss what's going to happen dynamically.
Exactly. So, but what we found by Henry Markham is that what is defined in LTP is that the response to the first spike can be stronger, but the response to the second spike can be smaller. And how does it go together with this kind of
experiment? So, I mean, you're right in raising that experiment. So that experiment is perhaps the single strongest evidence for what seems to be a purely presynaptic component of LTP. And all I could say, you know, is that it stands more or less isolated. It may be absolutely right. But it might be because it's a different synapse that everybody else has been working on. So I've been talking about work in the hippocampus. That's an experiment in cortex. I can't resolve it any better for you than that. So it might be totally right. You might be thinking correctly, but only about a subset of synapses.
So you think this mechanism is not valid, it's not valid for neocortex?
It might be valid for some kinds of synapses in neocortex and might be invalid for others. I just can't say. Well, so this is a fascinating new view that's emerging. This idea of the AMPA channels floating around and getting captured, and this is a rapidly developing view. There's really one paper by Roger Nickel, which I think provides strong evidence for that view, because they found molecular changes that they could make which would leave the number of AMPA channels in the plasma membrane as a whole unaffected and yet allow them not to be found at synapses. And so the explanation would be that molecular change altered the ability of the channels to be captured at the synapse. But this is a very young field, about 6 months old, this idea.
John, could I just make straight, what part of this is your theory and what part is experimentally established?
Okay, so this is all established. More AMPA channels being there is established. The control of CAM kinase to get more AMPA channels is established. The theory is the nature that it's accomplished by this linker. And we even think we know what the linkers are, so I'll come back to that.
But I don't understand. So if this is true, then we still need CAM kinase to do this bistable switch. Can those linkers or whatever other components of the system play the role of that switch?
Well, I mean, if this thing comes loose, if this thing is dephosphorylated and you start a disassembly process.
It has to be phosphorylated to bind.
It has to be phosphorylated to bind.
Yeah, but the moment the alpha receptor is inserted into the membrane, this is by itself a stable.
Okay, I mean, this is very interesting stuff. This is very, very interesting stuff about where the stability lies and all the structural cooperativity and what is absolutely necessary, and I think we have to discuss it later, and there's nothing known about it. But I will come back. I'll give you, I think this is the end of my introduction. I will give you my bottom line, most profound idea about which I know nothing. And that is that I have come to the conclusion that maybe the secret is that memory is a self-replicating structure. That that's really the right way to look at it. That that it's a structure, no one part of which is necessary, but that there's going to be some sort of geometrical component to it. It's going to have to maintain the switch. I mean, the switch is going to be integral, but there's going to be some sort of other principle superposed on it. Of self-replication of structure. And we'll come back to this. I mean, that's how I'm going to end my talk. And I just think that the big transition that I've had in my own thinking is from modulation to structure. So this is a structural, this model, as you see it here, has a big structural component to it. It's not that the synapse necessarily gets bigger, but it gets more complicated in terms of its components. And I think that we're on the right track. I'll just give you one reason why I think we're on the right track. Ever since the first day people came up with the protein composition of the postsynaptic density, and people were saying, you know, it can be up to 30% of the protein in the postsynaptic density, the biochemists said there's something wrong here. You know, you don't need to have half, you know, a third or half, a quarter of the postsynaptic density be an enzyme if its only role is an enzyme. I mean, an enzyme can do so much so quickly. You don't need so much. And so there were people right from the beginning who said CAM kinase must be playing some kind of structural role. And so I think that this model begins to give you a flavor of what that structural role could be. So,
well, certainly that's the view from all the experimentalists, which is that this postsynaptic specialization is really some complicated machine, like gears and mechanical device. That's being stressed a lot, right?
Well, I don't know if I would go into the mechanical analogy, although it's possible, but you'll see in the next part of the talk, I think we should have a break now, that in the third generation model of how this switch works, the immobilization of the CAM kinase in the postsynaptic density turns out to be absolutely crucial. You're making a very special biochemical compartment, and it works only because it's in this very special biochemical compartment.
Just to make your argument here, in the 30%, you don't count the chambers themselves, but you count other enzymes besides.
Right. There may be some channels that come along for the ride. The postsynaptic density is a kind of messy biochemical structure, and there are channels that come along with it. So
if you count the channels, then the argument is weak, right?
The AMPA channels tend not to come along. The NMDA channels, for some reason, come along in the postsynaptic density. So maybe we should just take a little break, and then we'll go into the detailed model.
That's great, John. That's exactly what we need.
Oh, yeah. Good. So this is what's called a holoenzyme. So you should be able to see the petals on CAM kinase. So it's got a rosette structure. So then, using very fancy techniques, they came up with this. This is the structure. So basically, it's two planar hexagonal rings with each subunit being a catalytic, being independent catalytic site and independently regulated by threonine 286. So, in a sense, I mean, everybody's been really excited about this because, first of all, we finally sort of know what the structure looks like, and second of all, is what is the structure function all about of this molecule? So, I mean, there are two obvious questions about the structure function. One is, what's the ring? What's the ring for? And the second is, what's the dual ring for? And this is CAM kinase. So you'll see that we have a ring-like, the model that we're going to present, is definitely a ring model. So the ring we think is crucial. The dual rings is another story. We don't really know exactly what the underlying idea for the dual rings is, but you can sort of begin to. So this is now looking down on the ring, and that green thing is the calmodulin molecule, which is of course the adapter between calcium, calmodulin, and the enzyme.
So calmodulin is also an enzyme?
No, calmodulin is like a little adapter. So calmodulin binds the calcium directly. The kinase does not bind the calcium directly. The calcium-calmodulin complex binds to the kinase and activates it.
So if you're going to go back to the slide before, I want to...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, here...
This is raw data, and the next slide is sort of EM reconstruction of what the molecule really looks like in three dimensions.
So here you would see three kinases.
Well, you see three holoenzymes, each one of which has these 12 subunits.
Yeah.
And now from the next
And the matrix in between.
That's also part. So it turns out that the kinase, if you look at the primary structure, has a whole segment that is devoted to catalysis and regulated catalysis. And then it has what's called the association domain, which is how it builds this mega structure. So that yellow is the association domain.
Just in this scale, what is the length?
Okay, so that's 20 nanometers. So it's a huge thing as a molecule. I mean, it's almost a million molecular weight. It's got these 12, in a sense, relatively independent subunits, but they're not totally independent. So this is going to be where the real beauty of this thing comes, that this is how the subunits interact.
Sorry, Miss, that's one subunit, or that's...
No, this is one holoenzyme with... So it's the critical structure is these two hexagonal rings. And so the model that we're going to come up with is a ring model. So phosphorylation is going to travel around that ring when one subunit phosphorylates a neighboring subunit.
Is it called symmetry?
I think so. And there's actually a hole. Well, you see the hole. It's got an interesting property, this hole that goes down through the center.
And before we saw it, the other...
Yeah. But this is looking at it from the top.
That's why it's called a hole
away, isn't it? Oh. This is looking from the side. It actually has a hole looking at it from the side and a hole looking at it from the top. So I think that association domain is very loose, actually. And, you know, it looks like it's not meant to be solid. It's...
And this dual hole is just one, or there are...
Oh gosh. I think on the basis of symmetry I can say that there must be more.
So alpha and beta were
Nobody really knows. It hasn't gotten worked out yet how the relative composition of alpha and beta affect this structure.
But the gold plots are not the same ring.
Right, so there's a huge difference between the blue part of the molecule. That's where the real catalytic and regulatory parts are going on. The yellow part is something to do with building this gigantic structure and combined to certain other things, and we'll come to that.
But one subunit would be both blue and yellow?
Yes.
And they would all?
Right. So this is just to remind you of the postsynaptic density, because I have a little editorial comment, and that is that this model that I'm going to present to you now, the third generation model, relies, as I said, incredibly strongly on not only that the kinase is immobilized in the postsynaptic density, but that the phosphatase is also immobilized in the postsynaptic density. This wouldn't, as I'll show you, it wouldn't work unless they were both immobilized there. And so we're talking about a very small compartment and biochemistry that is definitely not solution biochemistry.
So the postsynaptic is the area of the synapse at the postsynaptic cell.
Right.
And the postsynaptic cell, well, how do you call this? This is the DP?
The PSD.
Is the postsynaptic cell.
Right.
DP is what?
Okay. That, right. Yeah. Okay, so I remind you of sort of what the key reactions are. I mean, this is just what you've seen before. You've got to account for the autocatalysis, the sensitivity to calcium. And as it turned out, the second generation model failed in some detailed biochemistry. And it's pretty amazing why it failed. So I told you that autophosphorylation turns a subunit on. So you'd think it could phosphorylate a neighboring subunit once it was turned on. Because why not? Well, it turned out there was a good reason why not. It turns out that because the critical site to be phosphorylated is 286, threonine 286, that will make this subunit now calcium independent. It turns out that if this subunit is active, that's not enough to phosphorylate this subunit because it's hidden. And so it turns out that the only way to expose this neighboring subunit to get it phosphorylated at 286 to propagate the reaction is to have it bind calcium calmodulin. And in a sense, the critical realization in the third generation model was that resting calcium, which of course is always there, would be sufficient to once in a while open up this neighboring subunit and allow this subunit, which is active because it's already been autophosphorylated, to phosphorylate its neighbor. And that idea was worked out by my collaborator Anatol Jabotinsky. So this third generation model is sort of our joint model, and so that's what I now want to show you. So it's, in a sense, we were driven up against the wall by the biochemists who said this critical propagation of autophosphorylation between one subunit and another subunit in the ring could not occur in a totally calcium-independent way. And so we sort of now are thinking that the calcium that's required can be resting calcium itself. And that, where's my stick? And remember that what we're talking about as so crucial is this reaction. This reaction is what maintains the on state. And so what we're going to now say is that at resting calcium, this thing can maintain itself once you've turned it on, but there's also another stable state at resting calcium, which is this state. Yeah, because she did not specifically measure the autophosphorylation of threonine 286. So in that, there are other sites, and so other sites were continuing to get phosphorylated. So. Alpha and beta. So far, nobody knows why there are these two subunits, and we sort of, at this point, treat them identically.
But so the idea in the third generation model is that phase one alpha that phosphorylates other alphas.
Or betas. We don't distinguish between them at this point.
On the picture of this molecule, where is alpha and beta?
There's no distinction in that between alpha and beta. So, in the end, we're really going to be talking about a pretty simple chemical system. So this is not an overwhelmingly complicated model, actually. There really are only three reactions that I have to explain to you. And the work that this was based on is very detailed biochemical work that came primarily from Howard Schulman's laboratory, and which has been coming out over the last 5 years with regard to the kinase. And then there are about five labs which have really worked out the details of the phosphatase reactions and what's known about them. Which phosphatase is it? You know, where is the phosphatase? Those are the issues which are important for this model, and we've kind of collected all this information and tried to put it together in a kinetic model. So the first question we have to ask is, how do you get the first site autophosphorylated on CAM kinase? And then, as you'll see, something is very different for all subsequent sites. And this is a diagram which explains very simply why it's so much harder to get the first site phosphorylated than every other. So there's we have the words, there's a difference between initiation and propagation. It's very hard to initiate, it's easy to propagate. So the reason is that initiation requires the binding of two calcium calmodulin molecules, whereas propagation requires only one. And the reason for this is very simple to understand. You remember each petal here is one subunit with its own catalytic site, its own regulatory site, its own 286 site. And so two things have to happen to get the first site phosphorylated. First of all, calcium calmodulin binds to this site, and I mean to this subunit, and makes it catalytically active. But as I told you, to get this site phosphorylated on 286, you have to bind calcium calmodulin to this subunit to unfold the molecule and reveal 286. So that's why you need two calcium calmodulin to make this inter-subunit intra-holoenzyme reaction. So it's inter-subunit intra-holoenzyme. And it actually has been demonstrated that this reaction cannot occur between different holoenzymes. So for some reason, there's some steric properties which make it impossible for one holoenzyme to phosphorylate another one. So the only autophosphorylation that can occur is actually within the holoenzyme and between subunits.
That takes away immediately the binary of the whole.
Well, we'll come to this. So this requires binding of two Kalamadians, but supposing you had you induced LTP, you had this thing totally phosphorylated in high calcium. Now you go back to resting calcium. Now the phosphatase comes and removes a phosphate from this site. How many Kalamadian does it take to repair the damage? Only one. Because this one is phosphorylated, it doesn't need Kalamadian, it's active. Right? So you need to bind one just to unfold this subunit and reveal its 286 site. So it's a much easier to propagate, to repair, than to initiate. And this difference, as you'll see, will contribute to biostability in an important way. So this is really the difference between equation 1 and 2, and all that's really the only difference is this square term, which says that whatever fraction Kalamadulin you need for one reaction, you need that squared for the initiation reaction. So, but you can see that, the ring structure is really very beautiful for this. In calcium, you can propagate around the ring. If any site gets phosphorylated, there'll always be a neighbor that can rephosphorylate it. It makes total sense as a ring reaction. It's not actually known. And as everybody is assuming right now that the phosphorylation is a nearest neighbor reaction in the ring. But I can't say that a critical reaction has yet been done that nails that.
Because it makes the probability of binding much lower. It's not just keeping the kinase.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Well, anyway, we can get it work with that assumption. That's the best I can say. All right, so what's been learned about the phosphatase? So now this is the result from, as I said, from five labs that have been working pretty hard at this. And this picture kind of summarizes the PSD. Here's the AMPA and the NMDA channels. And the first thing I want to call your attention to here is this phosphatase. This is called PP2A. So there's this classification scheme for different phosphatases. Different phosphatases have different molecular weights, different substrate specificities, etc. But it turns out that PP2A is perfectly able to dephosphorylate CAM kinase. And yet, Roger Colbrand discovered that if you try to take an isolated postsynaptic density and dephosphorylate it with PP2A, it won't do anything, even though it'll dephosphorylate purified CAM kinase. And so from that, we understand now that there's some sort of physical restriction of the PSD which prevents PP2A from getting at the CAM kinase. We don't understand it, but operationally there's some kind of barrier there. So what can dephosphorylate PSD CAM kinase? Well, it turns out that a major protein of the PSD is this other phosphatase called PP1. And when you analyze the postsynaptic density, you find that almost all the dephosphorylation of PSD CAM kinase is caused by PP1. Then you ask, well, is the PP1 really held there? And people have found this class of proteins called scaffolding proteins that are holding the PP1 in the postsynaptic density. So I won't go into a lot of the details. There's an enormous amount now known about this. But the bottom line is that it looks like you've assembled into some sort of complex by this scaffolding idea particular molecules which are made to interact with each other and to exclude everybody else. So it's definitely not solution chemistry. Now, this here comes back to what Misha, I think, maybe may have intuited, which was that to get this system to really work in a bistable way, even in the very initial models, we had to get the phosphatase saturated. So when the system gets highly phosphorylated, the phosphatase gets overwhelmed. Well, we know that, you know, that's potential in any enzymatic reaction. Anything that has a Km can potentially get saturated if the substrate concentration gets too high. So that's not surprising. The question is that reasonable in this situation? Well, it turned out that we could calculate whether it was reasonable or not, because we know the concentration of phosphorylated sites, because we know roughly how much CAM kinase is there, we know the volume of the postsynaptic density. So although this is not, you know, maybe solution chemistry, you can still roughly say, and it turns out that the concentration of these sites, you know, is hundreds of micromolar in this tiny volume. But the Km for the phosphatase is on the order of 1 micromolar. So yes, we think that when this thing gets highly phosphorylated, the phosphatase is running saturated, which means that per site, you've got so many sites, so the phosphatase is working max, but you know, when you're not saturated, the more targets you have, the better you work. When you're saturated, increasing the number of targets doesn't help, because you're working as fast as you can. Okay, so I won't belabor this point because it's so obvious when you see the simulation. So I'm going to show you a real-time simulation of this thing now. Oh, sorry. This is a physics community. So I'm going to show you the analytical solutions first and then show you the simulations. So if you divide the kinase activity and the phosphatase activity by the number of sites, so when you start out off, you have almost no sites phosphorylated. When you're on, you have a lot of sites phosphorylated. The per site kinase activity goes up, and the per site phosphatase activity goes down. So you say, wow, if the kinase gets stronger and the phosphatase gets weaker, no wonder the on state is bistable. I mean, is stable, right? So just to remind you, why does the per site phosphatase go down? It's because the phosphatase, there's so many more and more sites, eventually the fixed phosphatase maximal activity is shared over more and more sites, so per site its activity goes down. But the kinase doesn't get so overwhelmed because it always has a private neighbor. The kinase reaction doesn't really know how many other sites are involved. It's got a private neighbor which will phosphorylate it. But it goes up after the first site gets phosphorylated, because I told you there's a huge enhancement of the kinase when you're doing propagation as opposed to initiation. So that's what this is about. So if you plot the kinase and phosphatase as reactions as a function of how many of the fraction of sites that are phosphorylated, you get these two curves, and they cross at these two black dots, which are both steady state solutions where the kinase and phosphatase rates equal. And the next this is actually a cartoon, so this is real data. So this is the total activity, and this is the per site activity. So you have to.
Yeah, but this is the physics community, so you might have to show some equations also.
Well, I showed you the. I don't have the. Actually, it's very difficult to solve this analytically, it turns out.
But not the solution, but just the.
You want to go back to this?
We have all the equations.
These are all the equations, but not the solutions.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, the trick, the actual tricks to solutions is that you have to model each state. In each state, you have to figure out how many sites are available for phosphorylation. That's a little tricky. And that's where some of Jabotinsky's genius came in, because you have to say, well, on average, if there are three sites, how many phosphorylatable sites are there now left? And that's going to be statistical, because if you assume it can only phosphorylate a neighbor, then you have to ask whether an empty site is next to somebody who's phosphorylated, or maybe there are two phosphorylated sites together, in which case it can't be phosphorylated again. So you have to take into account all these permutations. Right. Yeah, this is all steady state solution. Well, it comes down because that in the previous graph where it came down, we were dividing the peak activity by the total number of sites. So that was per site. If you don't do it per site, the activity just kind of goes up and saturates. And that's actually what's shown in the other way of plotting it. All right, so here's the phosphatase activity going up and saturating.
B1 and B2.
Yeah, I think there's a different terminology here. This is V plus and V minus. So V minus is the phosphatase. And this would be the, yes, I don't think these are compatible, from the point of view of nomenclature.
But how are these related to these? This now.
So when you do the per site, okay, that's not so hard to calculate. These are the per site rate constants. The trickiness comes in knowing how many available sites for phosphorylation there are, given that on average, you, let's say, have in a ring, if you have on average three sites phosphorylated, how many more are available for phosphorylation? The answer is not three.
This is some combinatorial factors that you're saying?
There are combinatorial factors which are on the next page of this thing. We can look in...
That's what this graph
is? Right. They're, and so eventually, even though the enzymes are active, there are no sites left to phosphorylate at all, which is why the kinase, if you have 100% sites phosphorylated, there's nothing left to phosphorylate. That's why this curve comes down again. No, I can't. So essentially all it is the per site rate times the number of available sites. So what you have to calculate, and this is where there's a little bit of trickiness, is for an average number of sites phosphorylated, how many sites are available for phosphorylation? And this is where you have to do some permutational stuff to get the averages right.
But so that should be some, the top graph should be some linear combination of B1 and B2 depending on how many sites have no neighbors and how many sites have one neighbor that's phosphorylated.
No, so this really, this falling curve is really this equation. So you can see that's equation 3. This is kind of a cartoon.
Well, they're not really, okay, so the functional dependence in the horizontal axis here is the number of phosphorylated sites. That number doesn't appear in any of these equations.
Yes.
Oh, it does there. Okay, all right.
Right. Right.
But in equations 1 and 2.
That's right, and that's because, so the only trickiness here is to know, given an average number of sites phosphorylated, how many target sites do you have available? So that's a per...
So you're saying the value at 0 is B1 and the value at 1 and above is B2? Is that... If I look at U plus...
Up here.
It starts at B...
So this is just the... Remember, this is the per site, which we're now... To get the actual rate of the reaction, we're going to have to multiply by the number of sites. But where does this come from? This is just this. So as this denominator term gets big, the per site phosphatase falls because the enzyme is saturated or near saturation.
Right, but U plus is just B1 at zero phosphorylated sites and B2.
Right.
The other way around.
Right, right. That's right. So this here, and this gets to be also statistically tricky because, you know, if you have a group of molecules, you have this, it's easy to say that, you know, on average, if you have two sites phosphorylated, but what does that really mean? Does that mean two on the same molecule or two on different molecules? And so there's a little bit of, again, of trickiness of how to do this kind of calculation over an ensemble.
So getting to the top to the bottom?
Okay, so this just says that if you multiply this times the number of sites, and this is, again, this is a cartoon. If you multiply the per site thing, which we can calculate here, times the number of sites, which you need a little statistical tricks to figure out how many sites are really available, then you get this. And so you see that, you know, initially the kinase starts to win, but then you get to this other stable state where the phosphatase can win, but there are two stable states in which they're exactly balanced. So I'm not used to giving this in front of a physics audience, and so usually nobody understands this until I give the simulation, but I have one more.
Black dots in the points which are stable.
Right. Well, so here, if you go this way, this is a highly phosphorylated state. So if there's a perturbation which gets you more phosphorylated, then the phosphatase now gets stronger than the kinase. So that'll bring you back, which is what you want. So just another way of plotting it is to look at it as a function of calcium and to see that at resting calcium, which we take to be 0.1 micromolar, there are two stable states, a highly phosphorylated state, and...
this is a kind of bifurcation diagram.
Right.
And if you follow, you always find the stability and the serenal bifurcation always in your equation.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
The stable solution, like the alpha solution, the zero solution, are always kept stable solution. All of your calculations find out that they are terminated by stable bifurcation, which means there cannot be kind of whole bifurcation that leads to oscillation.
I think that's... Well, no, I think that it's fair to say that we never did any dynamic simulation, so we wouldn't have detected the kind of thing you're talking. So in the steady state oscillations...
You calculate the stability of the steady state.
Hmm?
You calculate the stability of the steady state.
But, yes.
And you find out the upper branch and the lower branch are always stable.
Well, I don't know what you mean by always stable. When the parameters are within a certain range, and I haven't really talked about how finely tuned the system has to be. So the answer to that question is that you can sort of play with rate constants over about a five-fold range and still maintain this bistability.
Well, when you simulate the dynamics, you converge to these steady-state solutions.
Right. Well, the simulations are, I don't think we've actually checked that. But qualitatively, yes. Quantitatively, I can't say. I don't want to talk about it, but I do want to talk about this. So in here, what we did is to get rid of some of the interesting constraints that the biochemists said existed. So in this simulation where the bistability is gone, we've allowed PP2A to gain access to the postsynaptic density. So we've artificially eliminated that constraint, and you get rid of the bistability. Here we've said, just let's not hold PP1 in the PSD, but just use soluble PP1, and again, the bistability disappears. Why is this? Well, it's because the trick of the system seems to be to have this tiny volume and a small number of molecules so that the hyperphosphorylated kinase can saturate the phosphatase. As soon as you make the relevant space large, then, you know, just because one phosphatase is on one site, another phosphatase can come along. And you'll see this now, I think, in the dynamics toy simulation. So what is this toy simulation? So I want to tell you what you're going to be seeing. First of all, it's a real simulation, so we're going to actually see, you know, the statistics work out whatever way they happen to work out. And sometimes this fails, but usually it works. It's not real time in any sense. So this is a simulation where all we do is say, we're going to throw the dice and say, well, given the rate constants for phosphorylation and dephosphorylation and the number of sites, what's the next reaction going to be? So you're just going to basically be seeing what the next reaction is. So there's no real time to this. And finally, although you'll see the phosphatase moving around, that's just a cute thing. We don't mean to actually be simulating the diffusion of the phosphatase, although, you know, so it would look much more jagged than what you're seeing. So really, this is about the statistics of phosphorylation and dephosphorylation, and it's amazing that this works, because to make it visually appealing, we had to reduce the size of the pool of the relevant pool of CAM kinase to just five rings. So that's only 2.5 CAM kinase holoenzymes. And I mean, this is a very much a cooperative phenomenon. The stability of the system is going to depend on how much the phosphatase gets saturated, which is going to in turn depend on how many CAM kinase molecules are involved in this reaction, something which we don't actually know. But what this shows is that the system works actually fairly well with just 2.5 rings. So, let's see, can somebody turn this? I'll do it. So we do that, and we do that. Oops. Power. So here you see the five rings, and each phosphorylation site here, and if it's phosphorylated, it's pink. And this over here is the phosphatase. And so there's resting calcium, and so sites can get phosphorylated by that difficult reaction with the 2-calmodulin reaction. Sometimes it will start to propagate around the ring. Well, when we had to pick a number of CAM kinase holoenzymes, so you know, each holoenzyme has 2 of these rings with 6 subunits. So 5 would be 2.5 CAM kinase holoenzymes.
So this is a stochastic simulation with finite copy number. It's not the deterministic kinetic equation you wrote down.
It is. It's using those as constants to determine probability. Right. So this is a real
stochastic.
This is a real stochastic simulation. It could
finite numbers of each.
Right. It's exactly as you see it. I mean, it's for this number of sites.
The red one is the calmodulin.
The red one is the phosphatase.
The phosphatase runs after the.
Right.
The ring is phosphorylated. Try to develop. Okay.
No, I mean, that's just the way biochemistry works. It's actually, I mean, in reality, what happens is, this is a very small place, and it very rapidly samples everything, and it finds a target, and then it stops there and does catalysis.
But so, there are three phosphatases, three three pink point the phosphatase can work in Kegel?
Well, it'll find it sooner if there are three targets to find, unless it's saturated.
So it should completely saturate, and only when it completely saturates, it can no longer work. That's correct?
Well, there's more complexity to it than that, because there's also the kinase speeding up once you make the transition from initiation to propagation. So there's sort of two things changing. And so now what we can do is induce LTP. Okay, so now we got the highly phosphorylated state after LTP, and now we'll start the simulation. And the important thing is that the rate constant for the phosphatase is exactly as before, but it's, of course, it's got so many targets now, and it's saturated by all these sites. Nevertheless, there is some chance of failure. And I mean, the statistics of failure are actually very complicated, and we would love to solve this analytically, but it's tough. So it turns out that sometimes one holoenzyme will get completely turned off, which makes it really hard for it to turn on again, because it needs a 2-kel modulin reaction. And that turns out to be the point in which the whole system is vulnerable to really resetting. But it's important to understand, and you can sort of see this now, is that the group of this is what we call cooperativity through the phosphatase. That is, as you'll see in a minute, the kinase molecules do know about each other, but not through any direct interaction, but because they jointly saturate the phosphatase. And this turns out to be incredibly important, because what I'm going to show you in a minute is doing protein turnover. So in protein turnover, I'm going to take out one of these holoenzymes, and I'm going to replace it with an unphosphorylated one. And so it's going to hopefully adopt the phosphorylated state of all its friends. Well, how can it know to do that? It can know to do that because its friends are monopolizing the phosphatase and shifting the balance of the newly inserted kinase.
So why does the phosphatase sometimes take a long time to do that?
It's just because the way the program is set up, you throw a dice. Is the next reaction going to be a phosphatase or a kinase? And there's going to be as I said, this is not real time. So you have to think of it as, is it possible that there'll be 5 kinase reactions in a row? Yes. I mean, there's some possibility that there'll be 10 kinase reactions in a row without an intervening phosphatase. So what your eye is picking up is that, yeah, sometimes you get 10 kinase reactions in a row without an intervening phosphatase. Well, you'll see a picture of this in a little bit, but I mean, it could be up to 100. But what we don't know, and this is, you know, really gets to a very deep question, is, in a sense, what is the physical basis of this scanning process of the phosphatase that you're seeing here? Is it tethered? Well, I told you it's sort of held down. And Jabotinsky and I have been trying to figure this out. I mean, it's a real physical chemistry problem. Is the phosphatase hopping between binding sites? And while it's en route, does it do this reaction? Or is it tethered by a very flexible string? And if so, how long is the string? And this is now the limits of what we understand, or basically what we don't understand. So you know, I know you've been fascinated by the issue of, you know, is it a bistable switch? Well, there's some element of this as a bistable switch, but maybe you could have multiple bistable switches at a synapse and get 4 states. I don't know. Now, the physiology that's been done so far which is exactly one experiment from Roger Nichols' lab, I mean one paper, suggests that synapses are binary. But even when you say binary, you know, there's a little bit of ambiguity because the size of the synapse, you know, could potentially be very different, the number of AMPA channels. So maybe you turn on and off a binary thing a very different size. In other words, the amplitude of the binary transition. What? One what?
Mm-hmm.
No, there are 2.5 in this.
But there's cooperativity because of the all the ones served by one
right.
Phosphatase.
So it's a whole chemical system that is binary. Well, I'm saying, yeah, you could break it into pieces, but intellectually what that really means is that the phosphatase doesn't share these different groups,
right.
And then it becomes separate switches. But we don't know anything about this. I mean, this, we don't really know the physical chemistry of this phosphatase process. In other words, can it diffuse? Can the phosphatase actually go throughout the whole PSD, in which case it's a single chemical system?
But phosphatase is what? Just, you have just one red square.
Right.
Why not fluid?
Ah, it would be the same. I mean, it's really boiling down to the issue of it saturating, and we would just, you know. I mean, this is also tweaked. I mean, as I said, if you ask, you know, is this a proof? Well, not really, because nobody yet has measured the absolute rate constant for the phosphatase in the PSD. So we just adjusted it to find the bistable region. So we can't yet nail this possibility.
So the whole of your activity is coming from the data because we are just because they compete for.
It's the competition. It's the saturation, it's the cooperative saturation of the phosphatase. Right. So now let's just do one other thing.
But if one fails.
Okay, we'll do that. There. Okay, it just failed. I mean, you can either say that's a failure or you can say that's protein turnover. It's hard to come back.
There already was one.
Yeah, so this probably will come back.
Because the phosphatase is caught busy with the other.
Exactly. Unfortunately, I mean, this is a very improbable reaction, so we have to wait a long time.
So can I ask a question? In the cartoon, the phosphatase is better.
Oh, all right. Well, because we know that it's immobilized. And if you isolate the postsynaptic density, there are things that get washed out and there are things that don't. And the phosphatase is found there, and they've identified the proteins to which the phosphatase is bound. But now, so how does it scan? How can it be both bound and scan? And we can only think of two possibilities. One is that it's tethered by something fairly flexible. And I think in one of the cartoons, I actually showed a little string that was holding in the phosphatase. The other possibility is that it's sort of like it's almost like a restricted physical space. You're inside a cage of some kind. And you can hop around to various sites inside the cage. And while you're hopping around, if you encounter a kinase. Yeah. And then you can imagine ways around that. I mean, maybe you make some incredibly specific thing, like you take maybe this thing could actually work with just two holoenzymes. Now, two six-membered rings. Why? Because we've left out a lot of other phosphorylation sites. And this is now going a little bit beyond what's known. We know, on the one hand, that there can be additional sites phosphorylated. So in a sense, the 286 site can amplify itself by leading to the phosphorylation of other sites. So maybe there's even more capability to saturate the phosphatase than is illustrated here. And if that were the case, maybe you could get this thing to work with just two rings. And if you get it to work with just two rings, maybe you could actually hold the phosphatase, you know, in the middle, and you know, you wouldn't have so much, such a long string to get, you know. Anyway, there's a lot of interesting, you know, details, but the biochemistry at this point about these other phosphorylation sites is sort of not really understood well enough to sort of model it. So, okay, so we can turn. So, at this point, I just want to quickly address the following issue. I mean, this would be pretty amazing if it was all true. I mean, what we're really saying is we think we are close to having a highly constrained model of synaptic memory, right? This is, so, I mean, I think it's important to address the question of, well, you know, is it really the synaptic memory? Are there any other alternative interpretations? You know, what are the loose, you know, what are the problems? And so that's what I want to address at this point. So if it, you know, I showed you all these experiments that showed that you know, CAM kinase was important for LTP, but important for LTP doesn't mean that it's important for the memory of LTP or for the maintenance. So you have to have separate experiments that address the question of whether this is a correct model for the memory part of LTP, for the maintenance. So I'm going to try to review both the positive and negative experiments that are relevant to this issue. So the first thing is that I already showed you the experiments that if you measure the switching, it's not a transient switching, it's a persistent switching. It lasts for at least an hour, and we don't know how long. People have not gone further to ask whether it's forever. Now, here's a replication of that experiment, but not looking at CAM kinase itself. This is from Mark Baer and Rick Hugenier's lab. Here, what they were looking at was the phosphorylation of the glutamate channel at the site where CAM kinase phosphorylates the AMPA channel. And so what you can see is that here's the control level, and here's 30 minutes, and here's 60 minutes after LTP. So there is persistent phosphorylation of the AMPA channel at the CAM kinase site. But they did another critical test, which I think is very interesting, and that is, at 1 hour after induction of LTP, they gave a depotentiation protocol. And that, of course, weakens the synapse. And the question they were able to ask is, okay, does the phosphorylation of the CAM kinase site go down? And the answer is yes. So this is suggestive that, you know, there's something important about the switch and about the reversal of the switch. The next slide, the next slide is, in a sense, the successful performance of an experiment, which is perhaps the most critical experiment you can do. So if you think you understand the molecular basis of memory, you induce a memory, then you attack the molecule that you think is responsible for the memory, and the memory should go away. If you can do that experiment, then you probably understand what's going on. So this was an experiment done by Feng many years ago. And technically, it's an incredibly difficult experiment, and there's some problems with how to do it. But anyway, I won't go through the details of it, but just say, you know, here he induces LTP in the slice, and then he puts in an electrode which contains an inhibitor of CAM kinase, and the LTP goes away. So we thought, wow, that's just what the kind of experiment we wanted to do. And so Nick Utmakov in my lab spent many years trying to replicate this experiment using what we thought is better technology, where we could actually do controlled perfusion into the cell of CAM kinase inhibitor. So you don't, you induce LTP, and now you perfuse in the CAM kinase inhibitor, and LTP is supposed to go away, and absolutely nothing happens. And we've tried, as you can imagine, we're very motivated to see LTP go away, and we absolutely couldn't. So there are some technical differences, and we don't know how to resolve the differences with Fang. Other people have tried this experiment and gotten the same result we have. And so,
exactly the Fang experiment?
No. So Fang used microelectrodes. We used patch electrodes. There are a lot of technical differences which could potentially be important. We thought we had better technology, and we weren't willing to go back to the weaker technology. What?
Functionally, what's the difference between the patch electrode and the patch electrode?
Well, in a patch electrode, you probably perturb the system more because things can wash in and out. On the other hand, you can control the application of things better because you can build a little plumbing system into the patch electrode, and you can apply the drug when you want to apply it. So we could take a given cell, show that we had induced LTP, then put in the inhibitor and see nothing happen. If we put in the inhibitor before LTP, we could show that it was totally blocked. So we knew we could get the stuff in there. And Fang did, he didn't have a good delivery system. So he said, I'll induce LTP without proving that in any individual cell I actually did it. So he could show that he induced LTP in the slice using field recording. Then he impaled an individual cell, and then he applied the drug from time zero, and then he watched the LTP go away.
The diffusion of the inhibitor back to the postsynaptic density, is that?
Well, I mean, you know, you can like, say maybe that's a problem, but we can block induction, so how do you explain that? Well, we think we have an explanation for this, and this has to do with how you would build this in a sensible way. So remember, the on state is a constant battle, as you've seen, between the phosphatase working at some rate and the kinase working at a faster rate to beat the phosphatase, to rephosphorylate sites that get dephosphorylated. So this is what chemists call a futile cycle. It's not actually futile at all. It actually has a good reason. It keeps your memory, potentially. You need the phosphatase there to make sure that the off state is stable. So you can't just eliminate the phosphatase. But what we came to realize is that when we did the absolute rate constants in our model, which, remember, these are reaction, the kinase reaction is very slow. It's driven by resting calcium. We came to the conclusion that actually our model predicts that you shouldn't get any effect of kinase inhibition on the time scale of our experiment. So we inhibit this reaction, and then with the time constant of this reaction, this species should disappear. But it turns out that what God seems to have done is to make both this reaction very slow, which is kind of nice because it means that the futile cycle is there, but it's minimized. So in a sense, you've cooled the system down. So the actual rate constant for this reaction is one phosphate removal per day. So this is a very, very slow reaction. So if you only remove one phosphate per day from each subunit, you only need to spend one ATP to fix it. So it's very energy efficient. So we think that this system is designed to work very cool, be very energy efficient, but as a result of this reaction being so slow, you get into the experimental difficulty that you can't wait long enough to see it. So this was sort of hand-waving to some extent, and one would like to, on an issue this important, on an issue this important, you'd like to have some independent evidence. And so we were very excited by the work that came out of De Luca's group in Milan that actually proved that the dephosphorylation of 3N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2/N2 fluorescent yet for this. But what they did, so on a gel you can see using an antibody for the 286 site how much of the CAM kinase is phosphorylated at the 286 site. And they put in a general purpose kinase inhibitor, and then they looked to see whether the site got dephosphorylated. And they waited only 15 minutes. That just happened to be the way they did the experiment. But the bottom line is that in 15 minutes, they got absolutely no dephosphorylation of the 286 site. So in terms of data, this is showing that at least on the 15-minute time scale, the phosphatase is running slow. So we feel emboldened that some of the most negative evidence against this model might really be explainable in terms of the low phosphatase activity, which, after all, is sort of sensible, given that you don't want to utilize too much energy. Right, so when you want to depotentiate, you have a whole, looks like you have a whole separate pool of phosphatase, which is highly regulated by calcium, and which comes in and gets powerfully activated at that moment, and which then dephosphorylates the kinase.
But then in your simulation, you have to tune the parameter, the kinetic parameter, to fit this experimental result, see the work.
Well, our model assumes that, as I said, when you actually go look to see how it was set up, that this rate constant, the same result, we would predict that you also get no dephosphorylation if you waited 12 hours. That you have to wait on the order of 24 hours to begin to see it. So DeLuca's group is now trying to check that on this longer time scale.
You said that there is a group of people in vivo succeeded to look at 8 ATP during the year?
Yes.
So can you check this kind of mechanism?
Well, okay, so doing biochemistry, you want to do that on slices. So you don't do that in vivo, so you can't work on that long. We can discuss how this experiment is actually going to get done correctly later on. I mean, there are some strategies for doing this, and we can come back to that. Now, if CAM kinase really is this critical sort of marker for synaptic memory, so CAM kinase gets phosphorylated, binds to the NMDA channel, goes into the synapse, then in a sense you could say, well, I could read memory in principle by measuring the CAM kinase content of postsynaptic densities. And I'd find some that were low and some that are high. And sort of a corollary of that is that if you just looked at PSDs, they should be highly heterogeneous in their CAM kinase content. Since, so you...
assume that phosphorylated kinase binds to the NMDA.
I don't assume that. That's known.
That's
been now shown.
But when it's not bounded, you assume it will go away from the phosphorylated.
Well, at least some of it. Again, that's a complicated issue. So with Tom Reese's group, we've been actually looking at postsynaptic densities and characterizing their CAM kinase content. So this is a postsynaptic density, and it's been labeled with an antibody, and to the antibody is labeled another antibody that carries on it a gold particle. You can see the gold particles. So We don't know exactly how to quantify this, but anyway, it's a lot of gold particles on this postsynaptic density. But if you look through the group of them, here you find a postsynaptic density which has just two right around the edge. Here's one that's not even attached. So if you now make a histogram of the CAM kinase distribution in particles per micron squared of postsynaptic density, you find that it's highly heterogeneous.
This is across different.
Yeah, across different postsynaptic densities. On the other hand, if you take another molecule, which is sort of like a basic scaffolding molecule of the synapse called PSD95, you get a Gaussian distribution, sort of pseudo-Gaussian. So this is evidence that CAM kinase is indeed a variable component of the standard synapse, and consistent with this idea that it could be an information stored.
But it's bimodal?
I don't think we can say that. I think it's just, it looks bimodal, but there just isn't, I wouldn't want to say that on the basis of a small sample.
So could you, I don't know, imagine something correlating this with synaptic strength and showing?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you know, it's also been shown that AMPA channel density is highly variable from synapse to synapse. So the next step is going to be to do dual labeling and show whether AMPA and CAM kinase are correlated.
But this is a total amount, right?
What? So, as it turns out, this is just general purpose CAM kinase antibody. So, it turns out to be very difficult to isolate PSDs in such a way that you know that they retain their original phospho status. So, you probably can't do the experiment you want to do. So this is just to remind everybody that we'd love to know about switches at individual synapses. So here you see an individual axon probably contacting a single spine, but no physiology at all has been done at this level of precision. And so almost all physiology is done with whole groups of axons, and sometimes people think they stimulate one fiber, but they can't prove it. It's called minimal stimulation. And so the basic bottom line is that we really aren't sure whether synapses are binary elements or not. The one set of experiments from Roger Nicole's lab probably were done on single synapses and suggests that potentiation, he gave potentiating stimuli, nothing happened, boom, all of a sudden something would happen, and then nothing would happen again later. So when he tried to see whether he could grade potentiation at a single synapse, it seemed as if the answer was no. Now, you would have liked to ask lots and lots of questions, like, okay, if you waited half an hour and then tried to potentiate again, could you get further increase? Maybe there's like a refractory period. Don't know the answer. So, I mean, this is really fundamental. If we don't even know whether synapses are binary, how should we know whether switches should be binary at the synapse? And we just reached the level of our understanding. And another thing we don't know is how stable a switch should be. So, I mean, you think the first thing, you know, you'd want to say to a bunch of physicists is, you know, I can tell you that this switch is stable enough to be a memory. But this would be a great thing to discuss over lunch. Two majorly divergent ideas on what's required for the stability of long-term memory. So according to one idea, which I kind of favor but without much basis, is a synapse, just by virtue of its own biochemistry, could be a stable switch on the order of a lifetime. And I think it's possible, but I can't prove it to you. But Hopfield and Joe Chen have been sort of pushing an idea which is a very different idea. And what they basically say is that the attractor is sort of the stable element, that you can reactivate the attractor periodically in sleep or something like that. That reactivation of the attractor can refresh the synaptic memory. And if that's the case, then the requirement at the molecular level is only that the chemical switch, you know, be stable on the time scale of the time between attractor activation, right? So you could say, well, I don't know, how often do you activate an attractor, you know, for something you learned? I mean, I think here now we're just wildly speculating, but I don't know, maybe you do it once a month, in which case, you know, the performance requirement for the switch would only be that it had to be stable for a few months. And so, in a sense, I really don't know, when we're starting to try to set up to calculate the stability of these switches, but we don't actually know, you know, what the appropriate stability requirement should be.
Can you say anything about the possibility of a genetic mechanism?
Okay, so we'll come back to that. Let me come back to that in a minute. Okay, so I'm going to flash you through a bunch of slides quickly, which sort of get to this new structural idea, and then we'll come back to Misha's question. So silent synapse, okay? Just the basic building blocks. LTP comes along, we add CAM kinase binds to the MDA channel. There's this AMPA anchoring assembly, which then captures AMPA channels, and so now our current idea about what this assembly might be, and this is not the right audience to go through the details of this because you could probably care less, but based on a lot of biochemistry that's been done, we were surprised when we could put together a model based only on known binding interactions and get from CAM kinase to the proteins which are known to bind the GluR1 form of the AMPA channel. So this linkage through actin is a kind of novel idea, but actually has a lot of experimental support.
Instead of actin, it's in the muscle.
Yeah.
And you find it also in nerve cells?
Yes. So any of you who want to, I have some copies of our paper, and it goes through a lot of details about this issue, but I think this is really not our issue here today. So we can talk about that later. I just wanted you to know that, you know, there's some pretty grounded hypotheses about how this actually works. But here's the interesting point. So now you see the picture of the synapse all filled in, right? Now we've amplified and we've put all this protein in here, and we're holding the AMPA channels in there, and ultimately it's the CAM kinase that's binding, and you see the PP1 molecules here held in there. And this, many of you may have heard about synaptic scaling, the idea that, you know, depending upon the level of activity, you can sort of tune down the strength of synapses reversibly. But it's not the same thing as depotentiation or LTD. It's sort of like a gain control. And one of the nice things about this class of models is that it gives you so many points of control. So the ultimate information store can be, you know, how many CAM kinase molecules are stuck to the AMDA channel. But depending upon how you deliver components, maybe how fast you deliver AMPA channels, you can start to have these unfilled slots. So you've, by not providing building blocks, you've turned down the gain of the synapse. Now, if you start supplying AMPA channels again, you can come back exactly to where you were before, because you haven't lost information, you've just turned down the structural gain, in a sense. And So, I mean, this is kind of exciting because Tiriggiano and others have provided evidence for this idea of kind of a gain control, which is not meant to be a loss or gain of information, but just a gain control. And so now you begin to see how this structural thing can be utilized to keep information, at the same time change the gain. But the idea of all of this being so structurally dependent now has to be reconciled with what Misha was referring to, some of this evidence for the genome or for protein synthesis being involved. And this has been, you know, something that has been of very great concern, because it really goes back to those ideas that I described at the very beginning of the talk, which I really didn't like, which were the whole motivation for getting around the idea of protein synthesis or translation being important. So the general notion has been, well, yeah, kinases can be important in, you know, LTP for an hour, but after that, you know, the genome takes control. Now, what is that statement? I mean, what is the basis for that statement? Well, there's really only one basis of that statement, and that is that if you put in a protein synthesis inhibitor, or even a transcriptional inhibitor in some cases, then you can get early LTP, but then it seems to peter out. That's the experiment. And I think that what it indicates, or one simple explanation, would be that you know, you part of building a strong, stable synapse is a construction process. So in that sense, you know, this kind of model, which is a construction type of model, would be consistent with the data. I mean, you could easily see that you would run out of building blocks if you inhibited protein synthesis, and so you wouldn't be able to strengthen the synapse. And that's the view that I favor. If you really push the other view, it's sort of unclear where you come out. For one thing, if you say, look, there's a transcriptional switch, well, a transcriptional switch would have to be in the cell body. I mean, it doesn't get you very far in the first place, because it's unclear how you would target anything to the specific synapses that you want it to potentiate. But second of all, nobody's ever shown a transcriptional switch. What people have shown is brief changes in transcription, but never any latching. So there remains no evidence for a true latching switch, either for translation or transcription, which doesn't mean there couldn't be one, just means that that's the current state, but nobody's ever found. So I think the sort of take-home lesson that I come away with from reading the literature and thinking about it is that the idea of a protein switch that is localized at the synapse is really a very parsimonious way of looking at it, and that especially now that we begin to see that the protein switch can be, in a sense, the trigger for a construction process, I think we can fold into that general framework the data showing that protein synthesis inhibitors can have, you know, a profound effect. Now, there was a famous review by Squire, and nobody refers to the work there that is discussed there, but I find it very interesting. In the days when people were really working very hard on whole animals and protein synthesis inhibitors, they indeed discovered that, you know, you could train an animal, give him a bunch of protein synthesis inhibitor, test him the next day, and he wouldn't remember. But what Squire pointed out in this review, and I think it's very important, is that when they tested the animal a few days later, the memory had returned. And that would be consistent with this idea that, you know, there is some more ultimate form of memory, and that what is really being interfered with by the protein synthesis inhibitor is some sort of expression system. And once you fix the expression system, you can actually get back the memory. So, in summary then, I think the third generation model really is amazingly constrained model at this point. I mean, this has been 17 years of work on this model, in a sense, and with each new biochemical results, we get more and more trapped into a particular direction, and at this point, it's really primarily a summary of data, and pretty well supported by data at every step along the way. We still, can only have a very dim view of certain, dim is not the right word, but there's still, major parts of it that are mysterious, like, how does the phosphatase get activated during weakening? How is the phosphatase held in there? But, with regard to the basic dynamics of the CAM kinase and the phosphatase, the specific reactions involved, we're really following very closely at this point the cues of the biochemists and the cell biologists, and what's emerging is a picture of a very restricted compartment in which these molecules are very held and probably in a very precise relationship to each other, and which can then perform this switch function. So I'll end at that.
Now, for the fourth generation of your model, how would you incorporate the recent results about time dependent synaptic?
Well, I mean, first of all, if you step back from it and you say, what is surprising about spike timing dependent plasticity? Certainly not that if you have the postsynaptic spike following the presynaptic spike that you get LTP, right? Everybody would have predicted that going back to the earliest days of LTP. So in a sense, the remarkable finding is that if you put the postsynaptic spike just before the presynaptic spike, that you get weakening, right? And that the time window is pretty small. And from the point of view of the calcium hypothesis, the calcium level hypothesis, there's nothing too terribly surprising. Of course, lower you would get, since you don't activate the NMDA channel, right? You would get less calcium from that order than from the other order. Okay. Yeah. I mean, so you'll still activate voltage-dependent calcium channels, but you won't activate NMDA channels, so you'll get less calcium. So, in that qualitative sense, there doesn't seem to be any intellectual problem. So, then you could say, well, how wide is that window? Can you account for the very narrowness of that window? And I know there's some interesting ideas. I don't think it's tremendously complicated to account for, especially since it takes the spike a long time to actually backpropagate. And maybe what's happening is that you're actually getting a little bit of an NMDA channel activation, but only a little bit because you're working on the edge of the EPSP. So then you have to say, are the systems in which you see spike timing dependent plasticity ones where all of this is going on, that is, it's a postsynaptic plasticity, or is it a presynaptic plasticity? And I don't think we can get in that debate here. The one other major point is that it's important to remember that in spike-time dependent plasticity experiments, you arrange a particular spike timing, then you give it over and over and over and over again. So it's unlike the tetanus where, you know, you give a single boom. So, you know, the whole protocol can take, I don't know, many minutes. So you need some sort of integrator, right? And, I mean, in principle, the CAM kinase, you know, can integrate, could be that integrator. I don't know whether it is that integrator, but it could potentially be. It is an integrator. So it could be that integrator. And, it, you know, you could imagine that, you know, you just do LTP and LTD, and depending upon the spike timing, you know, you add phosphates or you remove phosphates. So I don't think this story is in any way incompatible with spike timing plasticity.
Well, except for 1 second, it's all controlled by calcium. You can see LTD when presynaptic spike precedes postsynaptic spike by two grade value, right? Which is a dip and not in a second dip. Is that the interpretation?
Not necessarily, because I mean, really, you really have to go into the details of what's happening during the improperly timed pair. I mean, that spike, they may be into. Actually, do people know whether the weakening process is NMDA dependent in spike timing dependent plasticity? So the weakening process is often NMDA dependent, and I think it just isn't known yet whether it's NMDA dependent for spike timing weakening.
More in general, with LTD, you said a couple of times that LTD is pure LTD, not the compensation, but we can maybe a different mechanism. But then, and it, of course, it would be compatible with the story for LTD, both whether it's a different mechanism that the person has some synapses or other synapses. But some of the implications of this story would be dependent on a lot on whether there are other mechanisms. For example, the binary system, you need to keep it out. When you show the kind of almost bimodal distribution of carnelians as a postsynaptic density, and the mode of zero would be the synapses that have never been potentiated, but they could still have a large spread of values.
I don't know what to say about it. I mean, I think you raised two fundamental questions. One is, you know, the LTD story, and I mean, that's also, in some sense, a controversial. You know, the standard in the field is you can call it LTD if it lasts more than 30 minutes. But oftentimes, you know, you watch it at an hour and it's back to baseline. So, you know, exactly how long some of these processes last. I'm struck by the fact that now that we're beginning to see the synapse in greater complexity at the molecular level, how many control points there are. So just CAM kinase alone can apparently lead to the insertion of more AMPA channels. That could be important because you could fill empty existing slots. CAM kinase could, as I've argued, could add new slots. You know, CAM kinase can phosphorylate existing channels and make them conduct better. So all of a sudden, we've got three different expression mechanisms and just for strengthening. And I think it's going to take a lot of careful physiology combined with, you know, cutting particular reactions, saying, okay, now I'm going to knock out this reaction. Can I still get LTP? What's the basis of the residual LTP? And this is going to be some really good, fertile ground for careful physiology. And another really shocking thing about synapses and why I don't know that the binary idea is such a good one is how much do you think is the distribution in area of synapses. So now that you've sort of seen a synapse as kind of like, this postsynaptic density. So people have gone through, done 3D reconstruction of the postsynaptic density, which is a pretty good measure of how big the synapse is. So I'll do a test. So now that you plot out the distribution of areas of the postsynaptic density in the CA1 region. So you could say that they're all, that, you know, there's a 2-fold fluctuation, a 10-fold fluctuation, 50-fold fluctuation, or 100-fold fluctuation.
100-fold.
You're right. So, I mean, that's amazing. So, I mean, if you look at a system that's learning, that is a learning structure, and you find that just the size of the synapse varies by a factor of 100, now I think you're forced to say that there's some sort of growth process that can determine synapse size that is involved. So how do you reconcile the idea of growth with the binary nature? I mean, I don't think you can. But you still could say, I mean, you could go to some hybrid model and you could say that, you know, all of the receptors could be either on or off, but still there would still be a difference between big synapses that were on and little synapses that were on. And there must be something that controls the size. So, I don't know. And the fact that nobody's been able to do physiology on single synapses and do structure function of synapses, I mean, I think that it's just fair to say that we're in the dark ages. What a way to end.